welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about a number of things, but it is worth noting this is the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Beyond Vietnam speech. So we'll be talking about a number of things around Dr. King as we celebrate a couple of things regarding him today, or not celebrate one and dislike another. Also, more and more happening around the issue of Washington, D.C.'s quote-unquote missing girls problem, and of course, quite a bit of politics around policing. But before we can move on, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, has ordered a sweeping review of criminal justice reform activities at the Justice Department. Now, make no mistake about it, this is the first step in the promised quote-unquote law and order strategy that Trump and Sessions have discussed for some months now going back to the campaign. Framing here is very important. The Trump administration and before that campaign created an extremely false narrative of the so-called situation with quote-unquote crime in this country. Despite crime being at all-time lows, the tiniest uptick driven by literally a few cities made the percentage increase look more substantial than it was. Also, since crimes like murders are so moving emotionally when people focus on them in any significant way, and America is a pretty violent country, it's easy to manipulate these things to create a certain perception. The Trump administration used this to create the broader concept of law and order that was multi-pronged, their concept of it. The first prong was around immigration and the heavily militarized borders and expanding border and immigration police forces. The second was around reversing changes to policing or even potential changes to policing that had been exposed, or policing methods that had been exposed as ineffective by activists. Which is another key point. While quote-unquote Black Lives Matter is portrayed as simply a protest group, it's worth noting that the basis of those protests are, in fact, fact-based. Policies like stop and frisk, when measured by data, fail to actually stop crime. They actually served as a clear example of how racial profiling is not scientifically proven by anything and certainly is totally ineffective as a method of actually solving crimes. Further, the protest against police killings reveal a few things in their wake via consent decrees and the like. That the use of force is often used in unconstitutional manners, i.e. the police are routinely violating people's rights. It also revealed that around the country there is little to no accountability around police murders. We could go on and on here, but the general thrust of the point is this. Whatever one wants to say about the rhetoric, the core substance of what Black Lives Matter is all about, that the police are racist, often brutal, and unaccountable, has been backed up and confirmed by facts. That most of this behavior has little to do with stopping crime has also been confirmed by facts. And facts in this case are quite inconvenient for Jefferson Beauregard Sessions. He is doing his best to ignore that they exist. And when he was a senator, he was in the Senate Judiciary Committee and was out of step with even the Republicans on that committee who were supporting some limited criminal justice reforms. Sessions was the lone holdout despite widespread evidence that things like mandatory minimums are problematic. He also stated in his confirmation hearings that consent decrees are ineffective. He stated that they punish whole departments for a few bad apples, totally ignoring that the reports that lead to consent decrees totally demolish this argument conclusively. For Trump and Sessions, quote-unquote law and order has nothing to do with stopping crime, but with looking tough. More cops with fewer rules is what they want, a semi-vigilante force that is about provoking fear, not solving crimes. The review signed by Sessions says that a full review should be done on, quote, collaborative investigations and prosecutions, grant making, technical assistance and training, compliance reviews, existing or contemplated consent decrees, and task force participation. This was also followed by an announcement that the Justice Department is seeking to indefinitely delay a hearing for public input into the Baltimore consent decree. While the top line issue is consent decrees, of course, it's also worth noting that this really goes much deeper than that. As it concerns grant making, technical assistance and training, as well as task force participation, they clearly could take aim at a range of things. For instance, grants for things like body cameras or various types of training or whatever around implicit bias, racism almost certainly seem to be targeted. The use of grants to compel school districts to do more about the school to prison pipeline also probably like to be targeted. It's safe to say that anything connected with President Obama's presidential task force on 21st century policing will end up in the trash. Now, many of these things were limited and perhaps not even that effective of reforms, as we've pointed out on this show. But the real issue is that the attacks on them have to be understood as part of a war against any attempt to address injustices in the criminal justice system. On top of that, it almost certainly will be followed by new stances from the Justice Department that will support the worst kinds of police behaviors and actions, like, say, stop and frisk. It's also almost certainly a signal that the cities that are under consent decrees are going to be treated with kid gloves by the Justice Department, and that they're going to look for methods of implementation that let the police off the hook on everything identified as being a problem with policing. And future consent decrees, well, they probably just won't happen. So far this year, the police have killed 304 people. That's about 3.3 people a day. And at that pace, we're already on track to have 1,100 roughly police murders this year. We had 1,092 last year, so more this year than last year. And ultimately, I really wouldn't be surprised if it ends up being much higher, because with this review, Jeff Sessions has declared open season on the black and brown in America by this country's police departments. Controversy about the incidental collections, now at the center of the probe into Russia's alleged and potential involvement in elections, has taken another relatively major turn. A number of right-leaning websites were able to obtain information that Susan Rice, who is the National Security Advisor under President Obama, was the official who requested the unmasking, the revealing, that is, of Trump administration officials' names from NSA intercepts. Further, that she then distributed that information to others in the intelligence services, primarily at the highest levels, but who, of course, they may have told is unclear. Now, this new evidence raises a number of questions, of course, but again, it raises issues about the abuses of incidental collections. Part of the issue here is that these various intelligence programs are shrouded in secrecy and their rules and procedures are extremely Byzantine. So making strong statements as opposed to informed speculation is difficult. However, taking one step back here, it appears that the Susan Rice information confirms tension between the White House and the various intelligence agencies, and it at least implies the White House is meddling here in this investigation, but in the course of that, also revealing important things about incidental collections that, to some degree, seem to vindicate those of us who have pointed out the problems with this whole incidental collection system and how it's a backdoor way to collect data on Americans. Now again, just to define, incidental collections are communications of Americans swept up while intelligence agencies are doing investigations of non-Americans. They call them incidental so that it seems like there are not that many, but clearly the reason they're doing it, calling it incidental, is to minimize the amount of information, to minimize the idea about the amount of information that they're collecting, which they refuse to reveal. So the communications at issue seem to consist principally of foreign officials talking about Trump transition figures, but some do seem to contain communications between Trump officials and foreign officials. Now, allegedly, these have nothing to do with Russia, which is interesting in and of itself, because what are they about? Turkey, Syria, Ukraine? Who knows? It does, however, point to the key issue we have been raising here, and that's the issue of incidental collections being a backdoor form of surveillance of Americans, which they shouldn't be able to do based on amendments to the Patriot Act. Now, these communications can be saved under the guise of something that has foreign intelligence value, which ultimately means anything. The declassification of all or even part of these documents now seems essential to understand what's going on. What is the standard by which these sorts of communications are kept and collected? Now, Rice very well may have been within her rights here to unmask them for top-level officials if she was sharing something related to some ongoing investigation, one that could have little to or nothing to do with Russia, or is tangentially related to the investigation regarding Russia. Or, and this is another important question, was what happened there an explicitly not permitted use of these communications to affect political processes, which of course would be a huge scandal. However, the determination of what affecting a U.S. political process means are determined by the intelligence agencies themselves. So it's possible, even if this became an issue, that Rice still may have not broken any laws, since the intelligence community monitoring them could be using a definition that's designed to make it easier to do this. So again, declassification would help us figure this out. And that's exactly the problem, is that there's so much of this is completely unknown. Throughout this entire process, we've had evidence that A, the bulk surveillance of Americans' communications is collected far more routinely than people thought. That B, the standard for which communications are kept is perhaps an extremely low bar. That C, there's a significant lack of oversight around how these communications with Americans are used, handled, and whatever, both through the unmasking but also through the masking that is so contextualized the name can easily be guessed. There is also D, the subsidiary issue of how widely distributed and available raw data is to investigations and how that information is being handled by the FBI, which appears to have very little safeguards, even less than the CIA and NSA. And you put those three things together, it seems that the claims many have made about incidental surveillance as a backdoor mass search of Americans' data is almost certainly on the right scent, but without declassification, it's difficult to gain some clarity there. Now, there's also another issue, and that's how the White House even found this out. Now, it seems fairly clear here that elements of the National Security Council explicitly went looking for information that could undermine either A, the investigation, which would be a much more serious issue, or B, just to help shift the narrative away from Trump and towards abuses by intelligence agency of the data of Americans, which, as I've been trying to raise here, is in fact a big issue. It also appears that Elliot Cohen Watnick, the NSC official who revealed the information that Nunes laid out, was almost fired by National Security Advisor McMaster for overstepping his bounds and searching this information out and sharing it with Nunes outside of official channels. It's interesting to see how those two different stories start to mesh together when you put the timeline together. So what's the upshot of this whole thing? Well, it seems that if the intelligence community or elements within it do not like Donald Trump and are leaking information regarding the investigation to try to either A, put pressure on him to not push any sort of rapprochement with Russia, or to try to drive some sort of process that could lead to his impeachment. It also seems that the Trump White House or elements within it decided to wage a counter-struggle in order to A, vindicate Trump, or B, try to hang the intelligence agencies on the issue of abusing the collected communications of Americans in retaliation. So at this stage, it turns out that the bigger scandal may, at this point, not even be Russia, but which element of the government is more aggressively abusing and the gathering and dissemination of classified material about conversations of Americans in sort of an in-run way around what the law is supposed to be. So while Russia is the top line issue, pay very close attention to the issues around where it seems to be issues around it, where there seem to be significant legal and political landmines. And those are today's talking points. And you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined in our studio to continue this conversation by Perry Redd, who's the founder and executive director of Sincere 7, and Aaron Goggins, who's with Black Lives Matter DC. Thank you both for joining the show again.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
So I want to start with this Jeff Sessions review process that's going on here. A lot of different ways to take this, but it just sort of seemed to me that what I really thought about this, Aaron, is it's the Trump administration sort of delivering a slap in the face to the movement for Black Lives and basically saying, you know, any critique that's raised by police, we are now moving in an opposite direction. Your thoughts?
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's crazy for a number of reasons. One, because most consent decrees don't get followed, right? So, like, the fact that they actually went out of their way to do something when they really could have just not implemented it, to me means either they're just, like, ideologically in love with the police in a way we haven't seen anybody since Nixon, or they're planning on doing something, right? Like they understand the connection to their mass deportation plan and the fact that everybody hates them to the need that they need to open up space for the police to be even more brutal. Because the sad reality is, even with DC's MOU with the DOJ, Memorandum of Understanding with the Department of Justice, you saw a lot of the most important key parts of that were actually supposed to curb police brutality not be followed. And as soon as the decree was lifted, the rates of police killing Black people in D.C. just increased. And so even with consent decrees, we haven't been able to stop police brutality. So they have to know that. I mean, they have the data on it, the agency that collects it. So to me, the signal is that they actually have a plan for the police to be even more brutal and need the police to be unshackled in order to get their plans implemented.
It did seem like an ideological whitewash to me, Perry Redd. I mean, you know, I think the thing about these Justice Department reports that I found most useful is that it just pretty much showed the few bad apples thing is completely ridiculous and that there's a terrible culture of brutality, murder, covering things up, the whole nine. I mean, it's in all these consent decrees, and that this is a way to whitewash that, to just hide that from an actor that it's hard for even. I mean, it's one thing for us to say whatever about the police when the Justice Department says it has a different impact, and that this has sort of a whitewashing effect.
Well, no further from the truth than, you know, than the nose on your face. That's exactly what this is. This is a way of validating the injustice of what we're about to experience for the next 3.5 years. You know, we are looking forward to, you know, them putting their rubber stamp on something that they hate more than anything, the idea of a dissent decree. And the great thing about Maryland's Baltimore's mayor, Catherine Pugh, she said that she, you know, the city would strongly oppose any delay in moving forward on these police reforms. I don't know how, when you're talking about an administration that is working so viciously hard to defund anything that has a semblance of justice for people coming to this country. So, you know, Aaron was right on point when, you know, say either we're seeing a love fest with law enforcement like we've never seen before, relationship between the executive branch and all of its underlings, or just a plain slap in the face. It is both.
Mm.
And this is what we have to look forward to.
I think it's a great point. And, you know, Aaron, to me, the other thing that this speaks to is Obama in a way, because he obviously didn't want to say anything about this. He was kind of forced to come out and say something about policing because people were taking the streets and it was obviously a big contradiction. But, you know, there was never any substantive legislation or anything like that that really came down the pike. You just had a task force and a bunch of recommendations. And like now all of that is just being reversed, like at the stroke of a pen. And that, I mean, it either speaks to me to a lack of will or whatever it may have been. But I don't know. To me, it seems like it adds an extra black mark in the way that Obama handled this issue. The fact that the things he claims he did are so easily reversed and non-consequential.
I just want to have a wheat pasting campaign that has a picture of Obama and says, "We are a nation of laws." Everywhere. Just wherever Donald Trump goes on all of Donald Trump's property, just, "We are a nation of laws." And I want people to be super excited about that as liberals when Donald Trump is the one writing and enforcing the laws. Right? I mean, I'm part of me is like, cool, can we just call for abolition now? Right? Like, at some point, like, they're just making the case for us.
Right.
That, like, all of those graduates who are now in debt that the Department of Education won't allow them to refinance can now just write all these blog posts putting up the Jeff Sessions' own talking points and being like, cool, so what you're saying is the police don't actually do the thing we want them to do. They do the thing you want them to do.
I think it's a good point. Perry Redd, your thoughts on this issue?
Well, I mean, I want to say it's a sad commentary, but we all knew what to expect when Donald Trump was heading toward winning the nomination of the Republican Party. As he continued to offend all rules and all mores that this country has experienced as progress, we knew that the deconstructing of progress, which is the topic of my commentary this week in the Black Commentator, we knew that this would be par for the course. So none of us are surprised, or at least I would hope none of us are surprised. But what's sad about this is this. We appear to be absolutely powerless. So basically, we let the train go down the track, hair on fire, conservatives screaming, going downhill, no brakes, train full of gasoline, about to run over all of us progressives at the bottom of the hill. We're in trouble. Sure we are. We're in trouble. And what I want to see is what I am seeing, and that's resistance, even if resistance comes with a hollow tip at the end of the bullet.
I mean, I also think this points to the danger of liberalism. I mean, I'm not one of those that says like the liberals are the real danger, but the liberals are definitely like a cold that that resistance gets that like doesn't allow us to actually do effective things. Right? This whole idea that like we're all individuals and that we need to come together in this system, give up our power to somebody else, and just be nice to each other and trust the rules and have like, you know, nice conversations about how we're experiencing genocide doesn't actually allow us to call out the power dynamics and the state's ability to crush people. And this liberal idea is really deeply infused into how the resistance even thinks about moving and how even some people who are on Trump's side are going to go with them until their legs are cut off the knees too.
Well, on that, we are going to take a break. We're going to come back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Well, we're continuing our talk on a whole range of things involving some of what Jeff Sessions is doing at Justice, some of what the police are doing that we're getting ready to get to in here, and as well as some anniversaries here for Dr. King and some other things that took place. But I want to just start with this other story, Aaron, regarding – it's actually an ongoing story. The Guardian has been looking into this for some time, the infiltration of the NYPD into, you know, quote-unquote Black Lives Matter groups in New York. This is something that was also an issue in 2011 that people may remember. I remember because I was one of the people who got surveilled, but the AP actually won a Pulitzer Prize for revealing NYPD having deep surveillance into a lot of protest groups. I have never lived in New York, so it was strange to get a call from the AP about why I appeared there. But either way, Aaron and Perry, what basically got revealed in the new piece today was that there were screenshots of organizer-only text messaging changed, which means that either there was an undercover officer who was an organizer, or they have an informant who was so close they let them take pictures of the things that they did. And I know a little bit about some of these groups they surveilled. They're really pretty tight organizing groups. So definitely some infiltration there, not just surveillance, which I think is quite interesting, given that all of these protests, and I hate to be like protest police type of guy, but 100% peaceful, no violence, no incidents, so really no basis to even claim, you know, how they usually do. But anyway, your thoughts on this NYPD spying?
Yeah, I mean, I probably should, like, go to therapy for my thoughts on on repression and the police, because I'll be talking to my partner who's, like, not in movement work, and I'm just like, oh, yeah, that's just the police. Like, when we're in my house and the police just drive by with meetings, and she'll just be like, why are there – they've come by seven times. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, that's just how it works, you know, and – and my sister's partner was just in our house, and he was like, oh, there's a light in the house, a blue light, like they're filming you from across the street. And there's this, like, weird empty house across from us. And I'm just like, we kind of just assume that this fits. That's why we close the blind whenever we have meetings. We're going to draw things. I hear, like, beeps on my phone. And we just blame random things on the feds, like other people check astrology, you know? Like, some people are like, Venus is in retrograde, and I'm like, it's just Bob at the feds, you know? That all being said, I mean, I think that there is a real problem, because I know the people I organize with are legitimately afraid. Yeah. I also know that, like, as somebody who organizes a lot, and it's just like, I can't do this work if I assume all y'all are the feds. That some of this is also just like, there's this weird tension of being super secretive, but also really open with new people who come and supporting new activists. And I think that's the real danger, is that we have to figure out a way to actually be open to new people who are being radicalized in this moment without being so security culture focused. And I think our security culture has to be really versatile. And I think Net for Freeman gave me the best advice on this I've ever heard, which is, like, you have to assume that you're going to be infiltrated. And you have to say that if you want to get information about escalating tactics, you have to put in work, right? And so it's just to make the system of surveillance work for you, so that by the time an informant knows anything important, they've been organizing for years.
Well, Perry, I'm curious your thoughts on this, because some would argue that any insurgent movement that's challenging the state would be surveilled. And certainly any insurgent movement anywhere in the world that has ever challenged sort of any state or large authority has been surveilled, infiltrated, attacked, or whatever. And that sort of the reverse is true. Not that it's right, but it's a sign that these protests that are taking place in New York that they're surveilling are having some effect on someone that the police view as important.
Well, you know, Eugene, my history, the history of Sincere 7 was founded upon police surveillance. When we first began organizing in Knoxville, Tennessee, I was a younger man with more hair then. And one of the pictures that Sincere 7 kept on the wall of its office was a picture of us taking a picture of them surveilling us. It was, you know, at the very beginning of my career, when I was indicted by the feds in 2004 for possession of a firearm, the feds took me around when they were trying to get me to take a cop to a plea deal. They took me around to places where I had been protesting. The TVA towers in Knoxville, Tennessee. They took me down to Fulton Bellows, where we had protested, and said, when you were here protesting Taco Bell, we were here. And they showed me where I had been protesting. And that was an intimidation factor, but it was also to validate what we already knew. And what we knew was that the police make a routine act of following and surveilling. And for me, it got so extreme when they were following my family, my daughter and I. Yeah, I was armed and I was ready to take them out, which came out in the pretrial hearing of my trial. And, you know, I had no cut cards, that if indeed I felt threatened, then I was going to take the stance that white men in this country take, that I will protect myself and my family by any means necessary. And for that, they were very clear. They said, we are going to take you off this map. And they did for 5 years while I fought the system and finally won. Lost a lot of my life and hair in the process. But I didn't lose my sanity. And that is to say that for the movements and those resistance movements now, expect that you'll be surveilled and take all measures that you must to derail them in order to accomplish your work.
Well, I want to switch gears here as well, since we're talking about this issue. I'm about to just go somewhat tinfoil hat on y'all. But I had never made the connection that Dr. King was murdered on the anniversary of when he gave the Beyond Vietnam speech at Riverside the year before.
But you did make the connection that is why he was murdered.
Obviously. I mean, it's just like, it's one of those things that, like, you know it, but you don't know it. I mean, like, it's like I didn't really think a lot about it. I know damn near everything about the speech. I certainly know about his assassination. I certainly have, you know, looked deeply into it. I look into a lot of these assassinations. But, like, man, that just, the conspiracy element there, I mean, it's tangential. I don't know why, but I just wanted to say that, getting that out there, that is eerie to me.
Who could have wrote that script?
Eerie. But anyway, here we are, Dr. King, both Beyond Vietnam and his assassination. I think there are really important things to be gleaned from all of those. Maybe I'll just start here, Aaron, in terms of the living legacy of Dr. King, cut down when he was trying to bring together this Poor People's Movement, Poor People's Campaign. I'm currently reading an unbelievable unpublished dissertation by a guy about the Poor People's Campaign and how the role King played in bringing together all these disparate forces. Interesting, very interesting. But for the Movement for Black Lives, which I think has also, in the past year or so, really made a lot of strides connecting a lot of different issues that are, you know, touch on, I think, broad parts of the population, even if it's sort of centering on how it affects black people, sort of I don't want to say it's the same thing or even a similar thing, unless you want to call it that, but certainly similar broad concerns as what King was dealing with at the end of his life. I don't know what that says to you that we're still dealing with it, and what it says to you about the necessity of movements that win, that sort of similar linkages and strategies are being discussed.
Yeah, I have to be honest. I'm like in my feelings right now. I'm thinking about like state repression and whenever people bring up MLK. I mean, certainly I'm no MLK, but I think one of the big lessons from the civil rights movement was that a lot of people just got locked up and killed and you didn't hear from, right? You know, I'm no Medgar Evers or Fred Hampton, but maybe Bobby Hutton, right? Like, I mean, there's people who just got caught up, and the like, it takes a real psychological toll on organizers. I also think that I'm very fascinated by the sort of path of radicalism that a lot of leaders take, right? Leaders who I think, you know, MLK and I have like pretty interesting similar beginnings of like religiosity and really wanting to love the other side of the table. And then it's just like, the more you repress, the more people are like, well, dang, what is the other solution? And I think you see that same pattern of radicalism across the Movement for Black Lives. I think there were a lot of people who from jump wanted liberal reforms of the police. And now those people are writing the Movement for Black Lives platform or reading it or teaching teach-ins about it. And now they're like, actually, yeah, imperialism is the thing. Right. And I think the longer you stay holding a critique of the United States government in your head, the more you realize that we're an empire and that's the base of the problems. Right. You can say that the main facet of empire is capitalism. You can call it materialism. You can call it racism. You can call it militarism. But really, I think the most accurate description that I've heard so far is just imperialism. Right. It's the dictates of a state that wants to dominate a bunch of other oppressed people to do the things that we're seeing until we really get at the root of that empire. And I think MLK said it well. I mean, materialism, racism, and militarism is the heart of empire. And I think we're seeing more and more people get radicalized. And I think you're going to see the Movement for Black Lives follow a similar trajectory. And now you're seeing a bunch of groups come together talking about May Day, right? Bringing back international worker solidarity. And you're seeing a mix of analysis from immigrants' rights to anti-imperialism, to the police, to people pushing back against the Muslim ban, saying like, actually, yeah, as workers, and not just workers who work for an employer, but as people who do labor for empire, which includes people who are unemployed, which includes people who are in prison, which includes women doing reproductive work, right? That all people who do labor under empire have to withhold that labor if we ever want to get free. And I think that is, it's interesting to see those parallels on a micro-fracal level, and also just in the movement in general, that we have a similar radical arc to a lot of movements before us.
I certainly am very happy to see the May Day focus. As the old song goes, though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. That's the end of the red flag song. It's the official song of the Labour Party in the UK. I think they would hate it if anyone knew that was their song now. But Perry Redd, some of your thoughts on the dual anniversaries here with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Well, again, I say, who could have written that script? No one but the FBI. You know, we look at April 4th in many folds, but it is not irony that he was assassinated a year after the date that he gave the Riverside Church speech. And for me, I am just constantly reminded that my life matters every time I hear that speech. As I get older and realize that I have not much life left, I am appreciative of all the people that I've come across and the young people who are following, you know, after me, people like you and Aaron. You know, you might not appreciate my contribution.
I do.
But certainly appreciate it.
What I appreciate more than anything is that you care and that you are doing something. And for me, it makes certain that my life was not in vain. And I felt when I was in my 30s that I owed Dr. King as much effort as I could give. And for that reason, today holds the most significance. As a matter of fact, just last year, it was my first time visiting Lorraine Motel.
Now a Civil Rights Museum.
Now a Civil Rights Museum.
Where Dr. King was killed.
And the motel means so much to me and all the people that put forth the effort, even with the lack of resources that it has, even today, when I think about what it could be, when I go down to the museum and I see the resources invested in it and how the Lorraine Motel and the memory of Dr. King has been cheated, in my estimation. But just to know that my people care enough to make sure that it exists for my 14 grandchildren that are coming after you.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we leave this topic, and I wanted to touch on that, but I have to bring this up because I think it's very relevant in terms of sort of the uses and abuses of Black history. So Officer Betty Shelby, the cop who killed Terrence Crutcher in a police killing so bad Donald Trump thought it was not appropriate, which should tell you something. She, for some reason, CBS, I don't know, maybe they're run by the Ku Klux Klan or something. I don't even know why they would do this. And you'll see why I said that in a second. They have Betty Shelby on there to narrate her murder of Terrence Crutcher. Yep, to walk through it step by step and say how she felt. So then they asked her how she felt about the response she's getting. And she's a little tepid. She says, well, yeah, maybe I shouldn't say it. Maybe I don't know if I want to say this, but it feels like a lynch mob coming after me.
Oh, my God. Dramatic pause first.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Aaron, I'll start with you. Your thoughts.
How in the world? Like, that's crazy. Like, to narrate your own, like, lynching of a Black person in 2017 is the most ludicrous thing. Like, I know history repeats itself. Mm-hmm. Like, there are all these parallels, mass incarceration and sharecropping, right? You still have human trafficking where Filipino workers are sent over here to be teachers and not paid for years. But something about, like, lynching, just like, really, y'all? And then they're going to use the word so everybody's thinking about it, mm-hmm. but being like, you can't call it that because I called it that first.
Right.
That, like, weird liberal white supremacist thinking. I mean, it's sort of like there's this weird mix of, like, liberals loving shock and the right actually being avowed white supremacists. Mm-hmm. They're, like, mix. For now you have this demographic to have these kind of conversations on national television, mm-hmm. right, where we're getting polarized.
And it was the Black dude on 60 Minutes, by the way, that helped her walk through the –
there you go. I don't know what to say to that.
Well, first of all, shameless, all right? CBS, shameless. White people in America, shameless. The police, of course, shameless. So she was well coached by the union, first of all, I'll say that. And well coached is maybe not even the right word because we saw it coming. We knew that she would be outrageous when she talked about the fact that he had his hands up. I mean, she admitted all the elements of a murder. All right. And then we got this set before us on a plate, you know, garnish and all around it. But Eugene, let me just say this. The Louisiana officer who was just convicted last week, Black officer, video released like that. Mm. The name of the officer released like that, officers that shot and killed the man who had his hands up outside the car, caught on video. But his 6-year-old son in the front seat with him was killed by the police officers. The first officer has already been convicted, given 30 years. Now, did you see that officer on 60 Minutes?
No.
Did you see that officer give his detailed account of the murder that he committed? How many times have we tried to get in this city, in Washington, D.C., supposedly one of the most progressive areas of the country, how many times have we tried to get the videotape and couldn't get the tape? How many times have we asked for the name of the officer and can't get the officer's name? All right, we talk about Laquan McDonald. How come it took a year for that tape to be released when a Black kid was killed? Okay, when we talk about Cincinnati, I mean, I could just go through all the states where we've had Timothy Thomas, where we've had, you know, we watched the killing of Black men, South Charleston, South Carolina. We watch black men kill and can't get the tape, can't get the officer's name. And here's this woman able to give this insincere dissertation, description of her murder.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, when I saw it, I thought it was a joke. I saw it advertised. And I was like, well, wait a second. And, you know, this is CBS now, so it's advertised during all these. CBS is America's number one most rated network. You know, somehow, like, NCIS, CSI, all of that is, like, the most popular shows, probably because it's just, like, the most mindless stuff that you can watch. NCIS LA actually got moved to Sunday, which means it's real popular Sunday night.
How do you know this?
So I follow the TV ratings, man. I follow the TV ratings, baby. I'm also a media critic. But, you know, so you know that, like, it's going to be huge. And I'm thinking, like, this – how is this real that y'all are like some? And I think so. This is fake. So I just move on. I act like it didn't happen, and then I wake up on Monday morning and it did actually happen. And then I'm reading it, and then the producer of this show, Bob, brings up to me that she said the lynch mob thing because I couldn't even get that deep into it. And I'm just like, every single thing about this is so through the looking glass that a normal person, like, who was the producer? And we, you know, I will say this. We had someone on this show mention this. I believe it was Dr. Jason Johnson, about who is behind the camera, that we have a lot of diversity in front of the camera, but not in the producer slots and the director slots and the programming slots. And, like, those are the people who would catch that and be like, nah, we're not going to have her on here doing X, Y, and Z. But since those people are like, well, man, you know, there's two sides to every story. But we're going to put a pin in it. We're going to come in with some more issues here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are going to start this off by talking about the current, I don't know if we call it controversy or whatever we may discuss in Washington, D.C. It's been national news, though, around missing girls, the truth, untruth, or whatever. We'll see where that takes us. We continue to be joined by Perry Redd from Sincere 7, Aaron Goggins from Black Lives Matter, D.C., and we are very excited to add Jessica Raven, who's the Executive Director of Collective Action for Safe Spaces. So, Jessica, thank you for joining.
Thanks for having me.
The pleasure is all ours. There's a lot of ways I guess we could start this. But, I mean, to me, the thing that really kind of, I don't know, was the most maybe galling of the way it came out was people start raising the hue and cries, a lot of missing girls. Now, this is something that especially black women, black girls going missing, not getting as much attention as white girls going missing. That's like a big meme, so that it becomes a big story. So then the government comes out and basically was like, the D.C. government, oh, we just tricked y'all because it's always been an issue, but we just started using social media, but there's no crisis. And it was almost like, this is just not even a big deal, really, but it is kind of a big deal, so we had to trick you into caring. I mean, it just sort of seemed unbelievable to me, even just the way it took place, the information that was rolled out, whatever. So I don't know, maybe your thoughts maybe about how this whole issue even came to light.
Yeah, so it is a huge crisis. It's a crisis that many of us who have been advocating to create more supportive services for runaway and homeless youth have been talking about for a long time. And it's awesome to see it in the news, but it's important to talk about. So, you know, what's really happening? Like, there's this whole narrative that kids are just being snatched off the street and trafficked. But more frequently, kids are running away. They're experiencing homelessness. They're running away from physical and sexual violence at home, from neglect, from family rejection because of their queer and trans identities, and there aren't enough supportive services or shelter beds for this specific population for 12 to 17-year-olds.
Well, and let me ask you this follow-up. So now Mayor Muriel Bowser of D.C., according to Washington City Paper, my nemesis, has come out with, even though she said at first it wasn't a big deal, and I do have to give some credit to Charles Allen, the D.C. council member, when he's like, well, look, if there's 700-some people missing every year, this is a huge deal. So then, of course, everyone was like, no, this is a big deal. So she comes out and says, I'm going to give $6 million, I'm not even really 100% sure for what, but to address this issue. I mean, was that appropriate to you? Did it make sense? Or was it maybe too little, too late, or just kind of whatever?
I'm glad that there's going to be a task force looking into this issue. issue, but we already know. We know what the solutions are. Right. Kids need shelter beds and supportive services.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I think that's a relevant issue, and certainly for those who are listening to this who are in the D.C. Borders of the District of Columbia, the mayor's budget did drop today, so you can see how they're doing on those issues in general. Aaron, let me turn to you here. You know, big issue with, I mean, this is my whole life. I think the first time I ever remembered this was like, maybe like JonBenet Ramsey, and then some little black girl went missing and no one heard, and people talk about it. But obviously, this has been a meme going back to the Atlanta child murders in 81. Just the response of the community, Aaron, to me, was also just a reflection of how so much communities feel unheard. And it was just like, I think a lot of people's anger that was coming out of it was like, there's this huge crisis with our girls. No one cares. No one ever cares. You know, like, no one is out here talking about this. Like, there's no resources put towards it. And beyond the issue itself, that it also just had this sort of like, you know, almost like cry in the wilderness of like, man, like we're just completely neglected in every way by the government, by the authorities that be. I don't know. It just seemed to me to reflect some of the dynamics of racism in America as well.
I think so. I mean, one of the things when I first saw it on Facebook and it was like, nobody's talking about this. And I had a really weird reaction to it because I was like, as soon as I came to D.C., it was a number one issue. It's been a number one issue for decades. I came to D.C. right at the time that the indictments and convictions were coming out for the police officers that trafficked black girls in my neighborhood. And it was a thing that was constantly talked about, right? It was a thing that was talked about when Obama had his, can't remember that weird liberal thing he did to help black and brown boys.
Yeah, My Brother's Keeper.
My Brother's Keeper. And there was a conversation from a lot of folks in D.C. that was like, great, you should increase the funding to My Brother's Keeper. But what's happening to all these black girls in our neighborhood? It's a thing that's happened consistently. I'm glad that the community is coming out and like being heard in this way. But I feel like the community has been coming out for a long time. And for me, the whole situation is depressing from the whole collapse in sort of the family support network and the ways in which black youth are treated, especially black girls in the foster care system. But also just how this is another symptom of the way that patriarchy and violence against women shows up. I'd be interested to hear, Jessica, I know you do a lot of work around street harassment. And in this conversation, one of the things that has been most devastating for me is the women in my life being like, oh, right, this is the thing that we all think about. Walking down the street, if you look kind of young in Southeast, there are dudes who come up to you and say, hey, you looking for work, right? And this like open solicitation just because of the economic situation, the level of violence in my neighborhood and the lack of economic opportunities, that it's become so normalized that a lot of the black women in my life were like, oh, right, this is one of those things that we just put off to the back of our head so that we can deal with like rent and deal with our kids and deal with like all the other ways that patriarchy shows up.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jessica, I'll come back to you for the direct question, then swing back to Perry here.
Yeah. So we know, yeah, of course, sexual harassment and assault is a huge problem in public spaces. But when we talk about trafficking, we also have to talk about what these kids, homeless youth in particular, are really experiencing, which is most frequently survival sex. They're in, you know, yes, men are coming up to them. Most frequently, men are coming up to them saying, you know, do you need a place to sleep? And they do. There are not enough, like I said, shelter beds for 12 to 17-year-olds. And so they turn to survival sex to meet their basic needs. And it puts kids in a really, really awful situation where, you know, 60% of homeless youth have experienced physical or sexual violence on the street, or they can trade their bodies for housing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's a good point. And, you know, Perry, I have to say, this reminds me also as well, you know, some of the properties that you know well that I've also done some work around in Congress Heights, that there's one empty building that the city is trying to give away to make luxury apartments to that's supposed to be for kids aging out of the foster system who don't have the means to get, you know, an apartment at a market rate. So, you know, maybe speaks to that. But, yeah, I mean, I'm curious your thoughts on how the whole issue played out. I mean, I immediately started thinking about Wayne Williams and the Atlanta child murders. And I called my mom and I said, look, my biggest fear is that they're going to arrest some black guy like later this week on some circumstantial evidence and he's going to get, you know, life in prison, like 18 life sentences in prison, and they're just going to wrap it up and there won't be any more discussion about like what took place, what was going on around it, which as you remember well is exactly what happened in Atlanta. There's a lot of questions about what was going on, and then it was like, oh, we got the guy, put him in jail, no big deal. Who cares what happened to those kids who were killed?
The key word for me, Eugene, is minimize. It's such an insult what Muriel Bowser did. When black women, when they cried out to the community to say that our children, our black girls are missing, Muriel Bowser came back and said, it's not as big a deal as you're making it. When one child is missing, when one child is ran away, it is an issue. And it's been on TV every week, every time a child has gone missing, which I thought was responsible of the local media to elevate that. Because I'll be damned, when white kids go missing, I see Amber Alerts. I mean, I drive down the highway and see descriptions on billboards. So it's never too much when one of my children go missing. You know, like I said, I mentioned before, I've got 14 grandchildren. And if one of my children have run away, which has happened now, my 16-year-old granddaughter, she ran away. And when she ran away, you know, for whatever the reason is, that's major. And for Muriel Bowser to minimize that these women in my community are saying, hey, look, this is major. This is happening in our lives. And we not, and I think we as a community need not be forgiving Muriel Bowser for anything, much less this,
you see.
And then they went on a disinformation campaign. Her and Chief Newsom, they going on every radio show, especially the complicit NPR station, WAMU, the NPR affiliate is here, and they're giving them all the play in the world to say, oh, it's not as big a deal as you. Yeah, these children, they just ran away. They weren't abducted. They weren't stolen. They just ran away. Just?
I think Newsom even said, he was like, well, 88% of them are found. And I mean, yes. I'm just like, well, wait, and doing what? What's going, like, this is unbelievable to me. And it's, I don't know, it just was crazy to me the way they rolled it out, which was like, oh, we tricked you using this because we're so smart. So we're putting it on Twitter, and that's why you're mad. But it's not even a big deal. And then when people are like, no, it is a big deal. Oh, no, it's a huge deal, and here's $6 million. I mean, the whole thing that it's just all triage. Like, none of it is really talking about what the root causes are. It's like, how do we get it out of the headlines so that we don't have to talk about it. Same thing with homelessness in a general sense, Jessica. And I think what I'm taking a little bit from your remarks, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think it's certainly relevant when we're talking about Dr. King linking issues, is sort of the siloing out of issues and the non-connection to sort of the social economic factors that lie behind a lot of this and the inability of the city to deal with it. And I say all that to say, this weekend you did a Facebook Live, I believe, for the Women's March. And this was one of the issues around the Women's March in the initial piece was, you know, was it a representation of like quote unquote white feminism, which really just means, you know, considering only the concerns of primarily white middle class women, not the way that poverty and racism and so on interacts with that. So I'm curious to, you know, what you said there and how you think the fact that you even had that platform affects maybe on how that kind of movement is growing and evolving.
Yeah, like you said, it's really, really important to talk about these issues as linked, because when we don't, the anti-trafficking movement, for example, can push solutions like more cops. We need to arrest the buyers of sex to solve sex trafficking. And then
so-called Scandinavian model.
I think something like that. but the Nordic model, right. The problem is whether or not you believe that the buyers of sex need to be arrested. It doesn't address the needs of the teens who are still experiencing homelessness, experiencing poverty, engaging in survival sex, experiencing physical and sexual violence on the street, and need to get their needs met. So we have to talk about, like you said, we have to talk about all of these issues as connected. We have to talk about racism, the fact that black and brown girls are experiencing physical and sexual violence at higher rates, and that might be pushing them to run away, and poverty and homelessness and the need for shelter beds.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Aaron, let me also ask you this. I mean, to some degree, and I think the sort of criticisms I've laid out and that I think to some degree people have echoed about the way, you know, the mayor Muriel Bowser even rolled this out, isn't this in a meta way kind of why the movement for Black Lives exists, is that there's this unbelievable, like, buffer force of these black politicians and business people or whatever that have become so accommodated to the system that their role honestly is, I think, to speak to Perry's point, to minimize the nature of the social crisis in black America and then to spin solutions that are either just like response solutions to stop people from being, you know, angry or, you know, to reinforce some of like the market realities and mechanisms. So like you look at housing, instead of saying, well, we need more public housing, just saying, oh, well, let's put more money to giving more money to private developers. I mean, it seems like that sort of maybe slightly generational, certainly ideological leadership rift, and the fact that the black community really, to my, and I say this on the show all the time, really is not represented by the so-called black leaders, is to some degree why a youth movement has emerged around a lot of these issues.
Yeah, I mean, I think you make a lot of interesting points. I mean, this is the part where I'm like, the anarchist in me comes out, and I'm like, this is the problem with the state, right? That, like, when you put the power on people who are paid to represent you, you have these gaps and disconnects. And this is also a problem with liberalism, right? It's this idea that we need to engage individuals in opportunities, and these black girls become mathematical equations, right? It's like 88% were found. So, like, we're good because that's a high number. The number is high, so we're good. And, like, that means 12% of girls are not found. Mm. Like, that's a lot of people when you're talking about 200 people a year. And I think that this is a time when we need to make the same pivot that I think you saw MLK making and advocating for in Beyond Vietnam, because it's not just this issue that there are these deeper systemic issues. It's also the need for a revolution of values. Mm. And it's also a need for the Operation Breadbasket, that MLK saw the need to actually solve the problem that the state wouldn't, like to get the community together to feed people, to educate people and house people. And I think this is the real challenge, because if we're honest about the movement for Black Lives, as much as I love it, we have a lot of things to address internally. And like, we have, I think, an obligation to make our own members safe. And I think you see across the country that we are really struggling to keep the same sort of gender-based violence that happens outside of the movement from being actually addressed in an accountable way inside the movement. And I think that we should really think about this moment in DC and say, how at the very minimum can we actually use our resources to keep people safe in our lives? Because there are people who are unhoused. There are people who, as activists, are having to make scary decisions to get food, to get shelter, and to get transportation. And I think that what this makes me think, in sort of my emotional devastation, is like, how can I make sure that this doesn't happen to people in my neighborhood and people in the movement? And I think we have to make that same shift towards what is our Operation Breadbasket as a movement to keep black women and black girls safe, and to keep everybody safe in our society. What does that mutual support look like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only thing I want to add is, so when we talk about 88% of girls being found, we also have to continue the conversation about, like, what do they need now to be safe? Because finding them and getting them home doesn't mean they're safe. The reason they're running away is because they don't feel safe at home.
Meadows.
Right, exactly. Brescia Meadows is a perfect example of this. She was failed by the system. She asked for help. And ultimately, she did what she needed to do to survive and is in jail for it. So finding girls, bringing the girls back home, I feel like that's the wrong narrative. The narrative that I think is really important to push is that these kids need supportive services and housing.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a good point. And since I mentioned Brescia Meadows there, and Perry, you and I have talked about this before quite a bit. And I felt the same thing about Marissa Alexander, that, you know, the whole reason that none of these black organizations ever get behind these women is because they use guns, and they've tied themselves to the gun rights lobby, which is about middle class white people. I'm sorry. I'm just going to be real with y'all. It's not about black people. It's not about stopping violence in the street in black communities. It's about middle class white people who think guns are wrong, and that all these so-called civil rights groups have tied themselves to these groups, and they will never defend a black woman, especially probably not a black man either, who's willing to use a weapon to defend themselves righteously now. Righteously. And Marissa Alexander, this dude, the husband, the boyfriend, told the newspaper, "I got 5 baby mamas and I put hands on all of them." I mean, quite frankly, I felt she showed remarkable restraint just to fire a warning shot.
Well, you know, it is such a shame when I hear any black person in this country tell me that they're Republican, number one. When I hear one tell me that they embrace conservatism, I get angry. I get angry because I know who my enemies are. And conservatives have been my life's enemy. Republicans have made a hobby of making me an enemy. And white males in America, those NRA supporters, those who are members of the Gun Owners of America, they know who their enemies are. They're well staked out. And so for us to expect that if indeed you embrace the ideals and idealism of race and racism and expect them to support you, to back you, to see why you, it's not happening. And it's just a fallacy. So I think, you know, Eugene, it is important for us to know where we stand in this society, to know that you will not be embraced by people who hate you, who hate your existence, people who despise who you are. And so for our children when they go missing, or when we stand our ground, you will be held to a different standard. I know. I was prosecuted by those people. They tried to take my life.
Yeah, I think there's also an issue of just how the double-edged sword of the oppression of black women functions in society, that if you look at Corrine Gaines, that you didn't actually see the movement support her mm-hmm. in the way that we had supported other people. When Philando Castile was like a gun owner, everybody was like, cool, he did it all right, right? But Corrine Gaines, there was this narrative like, oh, do we support this? And I think this has to do with the bind that black women are often in as not being offered the protection of domesticity that is like the double-edged sword of white women, right? You're protected by the state, but you're also enslaved by it as subversive. And black women aren't given that, and they're also not allowed the sort of self-righteous hero mantle that black men get when we defend ourselves with guns, and they're left in this unprotected zone. And that's why I think, in addition to everything Jessica has really pointed out about what we demand of the state to keep our people safe, it's also like, what do we do about that issue? Because that's actually a thing that we have control over, and a thing that I think is our responsibility to actually address, is how do we deal with this gap of protection, of social protection of black women and black girls, and what, as people who are in community with black women and black girls, can we do to actually extend the protection that we are able to?
Mm-hmm. Well, I just wanted to end with this. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. With righteous indignation, it will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money only to take the profits out of no concern for the social betterment of the countries and say this is not just. That's Dr. Martin Luther King in the Beyond Vietnam speech. This was By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By any means necessary.